This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Stephen King, documentary films, abuse and neglect come together in today's show. I'm featuring two speakers, one an academic, one a filmmaker, with stories in print and film that spring from violence. And in the process, they help to end the wrongs. First up is a presentation that Dr. Amy Canfield made for Women's History Month last year. Amy's a Stephen King fan and a women's studies instructor at Lewis Clark State College in Lewiston, Idaho. After that piece, I share an interview with you from documentary filmmaker Sonia Rosario, whose own experience with violence and racism led her to tell the stories of strong indigenous women and their struggles for fair treatment for themselves and for their people. We'll learn about Sonia's films, The S Word, and Idaho's Forgotten War. And I've got a couple of songs from Hungry Lucy off of her album, Glow. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and our theme today is art and abuse. What does Stephen King and domestic violence have to do with each other? Horror. Amy Canfield describes how two of King's best-selling titles, Rose Matter and Dolores Claiborne, have brought attention to the horror of domestic abuse, particularly as it has affected women. Amy's an assistant professor of history at Lewis Clark State College in Lewiston. She made this presentation to a live audience during Women's History Month last March.
I should start just by saying I am a Stephen King fan. I'm just going to get it out of the way. Judge me if you want to.
Woo!
I've got my people, and we are numerous. He's a bestseller for a lot of reasons. So there I've exposed my bias. Okay, and these are my props, because I like to have props, and if I can't have my PowerPoint, I'm going to bring the books that I'm going to talk about. Even Stephen King fans, which Kevin's the only one who audibly announced that he was, may not recognize these books. They're not two of Stephen King's more popular books. I think these are two of the most terrifying books in all of Stephen King's canon, though. I love Stephen King because I love horror, bad horror, good horror. I love it all, and I think a lot of people do because we like to be scared. We like to be scared if we read books. We like to be scared if we go to the movies because it's a safe fear. I know that when I finish a Stephen King book that the clown in It is not going to come after me, most likely, that Cujo is not going to come after me. I'm safe as soon as I close those pages. For a lot of people, though, the horror is not always confined to the pages. For women, and I am going to focus on women as victims of domestic abuse, their lives are much more terrifying than what Stephen King could ever convey. So today I want to talk about domestic violence, how the feminist movement of the 60s and 70s brought a lot of attention to it, sought to solve why it occurred, what society could do about it, and then during the 1980s, how there was a backlash against feminism and how this impacted a lot of those achievements that the feminists had actually cleared through. During the 1980s, during this backlash against feminism, we see throughout popular culture women being treated substantially different. And I think popular culture is a really good way to kind of gauge what's going on in society. It reflects what's going on in larger society, but larger popular culture has the ability to shape what should be going on in society. And I think it's very important that America's premier horror writer, Stephen King, chose to write about domestic abuse during this period of a backlash against feminism and against feminist causes. And one of those was definitely domestic abuse. So I think it's incredibly telling. I also think it's telling that not a lot of Stephen King fans read these. Stephen King, again, is known for pretty gruesome villains, if you've read his works or seen some bad movie adaptations. Pennywise the Clown in It is very scary. You can tell right away he's a villain. Cujo, the rabid St. Bernard in Cujo, very scary. In The Stand, we have a very outwardly frightening villain. King, in my humble opinion, is at his best when his villains are outwardly completely normal. It's the husband down the street. It's the lawyer you run into at the deli. It's the investment banker with his proud family. They come across all smiles. But then King delves deeper into that, showing what maybe those happy smiles are hiding in the privacy of the home. And he's very, very good in doing this. So I'm going to go over just really quickly plot summaries of these books and then tie them into larger themes that King was exploring in them. So the first one is this, Rose Matter. Has anyone ever read it? No. Many times I've read it. Okay, in this book, it's not as supernatural as a lot of other Stephen King books. It starts with the character Rose Daniels. She's a wife. She's been married for 14 years. Her husband's a cop. He's pretty large, and he's incredibly brutal. Over the course of their 15 years of marriage, she suffered bloody noses, broken bones, countless black eyes, and even a miscarriage when he punched her in the stomach, and King talks about this all fairly graphically, and then pushed her down the stairs. She stays with him through all of this, which is a fairly common thing for many people who suffer from domestic abuse. One event triggers her to leave finally, and it's seemingly a small one, after the miscarriage, after the black eyes, after the broken bones. She's making her bed one morning, and she sees on her pillow a drop of blood. One drop of blood. It's from a nosebleed she'd had the night before. That one drop of blood summed up her whole marriage. And she knew that if she stayed with Norman, he was going to kill her physically, just as he had spent the last 14 years killing her psychologically, constantly telling her she was worthless, that she didn't deserve better, that she had no escape. She decides right then and there to leave. And she knows she's not safe in town, that he'll send his cop friends after her, so she's got to leave town. She doesn't have any money because she has no job. Norman would never allow her to have a job. So she takes her grocery money for the week, goes down to the bus station, and buys a ticket for as far as her money will take her, which turns out to be 500 miles away. She arrives at the bus station in this new city, penniless and completely friendless. At the bus station, there's a traveler's help. She goes there, she says, I've been in a very brutal marriage, I need help, what can you do? This guy's supposed to be like, oh, go downtown, find taxis. He's not there to provide help to domestic violence sufferers. But he had volunteered at a domestic abuse shelter. He said, I know a shelter where I can take you. It's called Daughters and Sisters. This man took her there, and it's here at the shelter, Daughters and Sisters, that she starts to recuperate. She sees that she's not alone. There are a lot of women who had also suffered. She's taught self-defense there, and they help her find a job. Throughout the course of the book, though, Norman is not content with just letting her go. And he tracks her down. He used some of his detective skills, and he might have some supernatural skills going on. King just kind of hints around that. He tracks her down, and he kills anyone who stands in his way, very, very brutally. He had killed some people on the job, too. His violence was not just limited to Rose. Finally tracks her down. Here's where the supernatural King part comes in. She escapes into a painting to this other world where it was a matriarchal society where women were on top. And in this world, domestic abusers like Norman did not get off scot-free, and he meets a fairly brutal death in this. Spoiler alert, by the way. Sorry, I will spoil the endings of both of these books. You should still read them. So he dies, and she comes back and she starts her life anew. So that's that book. There's a lot more to it. It's really good. You should read it. And then I want to summarize this one, Dolores Claiborne. They made a movie out of it a few years ago with Kathy Bates. The book kind of goes away from the movie goes away from the book, but that's okay. This book isn't just about spousal abuse. It details one man's very, very violent reign over his entire family. It concerns Dolores Claiborne and her husband, Joe. They had been married for about 20 years. And the book takes place in the early 1990s, and she's looking back to the 1960s when she killed her husband. So it's done in flashback form. She tells this story in the 90s to some cops who had arrested her because she was under suspicion for having murdered someone else. She actually didn't murder that person. And she finally tells the story of how she killed Joe. Joe had been abusing her for 20 years. All throughout the course of their marriage, he beat her daily, and then he started threatening the kids. When Dolores finally starts to fight back, physically fighting back, he says, fine, I won't bother you anymore. And he turns his attention instead to their teenage daughter, Selena. And his attention to her is not only violent, it also turns sexual. And this is the point when Dolores says, I have to leave. Her decision to leave was not prompted by her own abuse. It was prompted by the threat against her daughter. She had been working for the entire course of their marriage. Joe had worked whenever he kind of felt like it. She had opened up a bank account in her own name and deposited a lot of her money there. And she thought, I can take this money, take my kids, and escape Joe. Joe found out about this bank account, and he went there. Even though his name wasn't on the bank account, it was only in her name, he took all the money out. The bank allowed him to take the money out. He was the husband, she was his wife, she was his property, therefore her money was his. He took it, wasted it all in one day, and then gloats to Dolores that he did that. She now has no avenue of escape. This is in the 1960s, in the early 1960s. There weren't a lot of domestic abuse shelters around. She didn't have a lot of options. She decides instead to kill her husband. It was a suggestion by her boss, Vera Donovan, who's actually the person she's accused of killing later, says maybe Joe should meet with an untimely accident. Dolores thinks this might work. She waits for an eclipse because she knows that there's going to be a solar eclipse and everyone in town's going to be concentrated on that. No one's going to be paying attention to what she does. She ends up getting Joe to chase her across the lawn. He falls down a mine shaft and he's dead. She gets away with it. In that she's not arrested. But everyone in town knew that she had done it, and they knew why she did it too. Everyone knew that Joe abused her, but no one had stepped in. So that's the plot of that book. And what I want to talk about with these two books is the themes that King had brought up. He was bringing up some very clear themes that feminism had brought up and challenging why society seemed to be ignoring this horrible problem of domestic abuse in the late 1980s. Feminists in the 1960s and 1970s started to bring a lot of attention to this problem of domestic abuse. It wasn't something new. Domestic abuse wasn't something that just sprouted up in the 1960s and 1970s. We've got documentation. It's gone on for as long as humans have existed. But feminists re-exposed it to the world and showed that it wasn't a private problem. This wasn't something that just happened inside of homes, that it reflected larger problems in society. In a society that set men up on top with women below them, there would be examples where men abused this power. It was just part of the patriarchal system. So they were challenging the entire system of patriarchy. They were saying there are economic causes. If women are economically dependent upon their husbands, this might make the husband feel like he has even more control. It might validate him in doing whatever he wanted with her. They talked about society's belief in the sanctity of marriage, that a woman should suffer through whatever her marriage brought, because it was more important to keep the marriage intact than it was to keep maybe her physical or mental well-being intact. Feminists talked about the lack of options that women had. They could call the cops, maybe. Up until the mid-1960s, though, police departments followed, for the most part, what they called the stitch rule. If they showed up to a complaint and the woman didn't require stitches, they wouldn't do anything. They also followed what they called the rule of thumb law. If he wasn't abusing her with anything larger than his thumb, it didn't get classified as abuse. Some of this is documented in police department memos. Some of it was just kind of understood by most of the department. Even if the police did arrest the man for abusing his wife, there weren't a lot of legal avenues still, and he could get off scot-free in most cases. For women who did not call the police officers, maybe they would turn to their friends and family. Women rarely suffer domestic abuse in silence. People almost always know about it. Some friends or some family. You can only hide things for so long. A lot of people, a lot of scholars, sociologists, historians, criminologists have said a lot of friends and family didn't pay attention to it because it kind of put them to blame too. If they hadn't done something before and they knew about it, then when the woman actually goes to them and says, I've been abused, they felt like they were being blamed too. So sometimes they didn't always help out. Or sometimes family and friends said, you owe it to your husband to try again, pushing women back into that relationship. Again, this belief in the sanctity of marriage. Feminists were very much challenging these things, saying we've got to change the laws. We have to change reporting procedures. We have to provide avenues of escape for women. Whether that's economically, there have to be more jobs available to them. Society should maybe provide daycares if they have children so that they can actually get out of the house and work. And there need to be shelters for them to go, to actually have a safe place to stay. A lot of these things start to get passed in the 1970s, due a lot to the feminist movement. some other movements as well, but the feminists again had brought a lot of attention to it. We see reporting procedures improve in the 1970s. We see more men being prosecuted, and more federal, state, and regional funding was opened up for these domestic abuse shelters. Things started to change abruptly in the 1980s. The 1980s is known politically for being a more conservative decade. The new right had kind of reemerged in the 1980s. That also trickled down to social issues. And feminism as a whole suffered in the 1980s. There was this massive backlash against it, where people thought that the feminists had perhaps gone too far. They had passed what they called unnecessary legislation, that they were wasting federal dollars on these domestic abuse shelters. And there was a lot of cries to shut these things out. And we see this throughout a lot of popular culture too, against this, again, this backlash against females. And if you've read this book, Backlash by Susan Faludi, she very much details it. Also another excellent book. That one's not gonna stand, that's okay. If you've seen the movie Fatal Attraction, that's very much a backlash against women. The movie's much different from the original screenplay. In the movie, the feminist gets punished throughout the movie. She does have an affair with a married man. The married man is also punished, but he comes across looking like the good guy. His wife, who is not feminist, comes across looking like almost a saint. That one was done in 1987. Also in 1987, we see Baby Boom with Diane Keaton. That movie, she's a high-powered career woman. She's very feminist as well. She ends up adopting this child. I think her cousin dies or something like that, and she gets his child. And she quickly learns that high-powered careers and children simply don't mix. She can't be changing diapers while at work. So she quits her job to take care of this child. She can't have both. She had to give up some of her feminist ways to be a true woman. And we see this throughout a lot of popular culture. This is more mainstream popular culture. And for those of you in my pop culture class, just ignore this because you've heard it a lot. I compare it to borrow Leroy Ashby's term, the big tent of a circus and the sideshow. The big tent is that mainstream culture. This is where we can see a lot of the mainstream ideas. The sideshow, that's where the oddities are. That's where the curiosities are. And it's the sideshow that's able to question what's going on in society. And horror, in a lot of ways, the horror genre, achieved that sideshow status. Even though King was very popular by his time, he was still kind of in that sideshow. Much of mainstream America shut him out. He was able to use these two books to question these beliefs, to question why there was such a backlash against feminism. A lot of more conservative politicians in the 1980s weren't even subtle about blaming feminism for problems. Feminists were blamed in the 1980s for rising levels of drug abuse, divorce rates, and oddly enough, for domestic abuse. A lot of conservative politicians said that feminists had gotten too mouthy, and that's why maybe men beat their wives. They actually said these things. One Republican senator from New Hampshire said that the government should cut federal funding to domestic abuse shelters because domestic abuse shelters provide a way for women to escape families. Therefore, they were missionaries of war on the family institution itself. And they were going to destroy family values and community values. The domestic abuse shelters. And he said, the feminists made us pass through this legislation. We should get rid of it. They're warring against the family. So again, we've got this backlash. And this is when Stephen King published these two books. Dolores Claiborne was published in 92 and Rose Madder in 95, or else opposite, I can't remember. And he was questioning these things, and he brings up a lot of the themes. Rose was completely isolated. She had no family early on in her marriage. Her parents and her brother were killed in a car wreck. She had no friends. Norman wouldn't allow her to leave the house unless she was supervised. She always had to be with him. She never had any friends over. He would have friends over. They were all police officers. She felt like she had no one to turn to. And even when his police officer friends came over, many of them would see her black eyes, see that her nose was out of joint, that he had broken it, see her arm in a cast. None of them would say a word. She was completely isolated. This was a common theme for many people who suffered from domestic abuse. They had no one to turn to. She was economically dependent upon her husband. He wouldn't allow her to work. That also made her feel like she had absolutely no options. And she felt like society would judge her if she left her husband, if she had given up on her marriage. She felt like no one would ever accept her. And it's once again when she escapes, when she gets to that domestic abuse shelter, daughters and sisters. And this is so incredibly important. And Stephen King uses that shelter so well in the novel to show Rose, you're not alone. All these women here also suffered through it. This wasn't something that you deserved on your own. Norman was constantly telling her she was worthless. She had brought about the abuse. She hadn't set the table correctly, made the bed correctly, or she had just gone out of line. She saw that's not exactly the case. It also taught her self-defense, which didn't prove to help her too much because he seemed to have these supernatural powers, but the self-defense gave her back some self-esteem that Norman had been eroding for 14 years. Made her feel a little bit more powerful, and it gave her a job. And she says throughout the novel, as she becomes more aware of her value, that she would never become economically dependent upon anyone again, because it would put her in this powerless situation where someone might be able to get away with things. And King uses that very, very well. In Dolores Claiborne, King picks up on some of the sexual politics of the time in the 1960s, where Joe could just go in and shut out a bank account that his name wasn't on simply because it was his wife's. That's pretty telling. That the whole town knew of the abuse and no one did anything. And the town, by the way, was set on an island. It's called Little Tall Island. And I think that that's a really good metaphor. The island was a little bit isolated from the mainland, just like women would be isolated in a domestic violence situation. Again, the whole town knew that he beat her. They knew that she killed him. They knew why she killed him. They just didn't know how she did it because they never found a body. But no one did anything. So when we talk about domestic abuse, it seems like a lot of the women who suffer from it are perhaps nameless or faceless. Stephen King, again, America's premier horror writer, brought attention to this problem. Again, after the backlash against feminism in the late 1980s, early 1990s, here is America's scariest writer saying, it's still a problem. And women aren't to blame. Maybe the men themselves aren't to blame. Maybe larger problems in society are. And if it's society's problem, society has a responsibility to fix these problems.
Dr. Amy Canfield made that presentation at Lewis Clark State College in Lewiston, Idaho, in March 2009. Here's singer-songwriter Hungry Lucy with Fearful from the album Glow.
Take me home.
This is Yin Radio with a show on the theme of art and abuse. Up next, my 2008 interview with filmmaker Sonia Rosario followed a viewing of her documentary called Idaho's Forgotten War. Sonia has made two films about strong indigenous women, the S-word, which brought attention to the efforts of Native Americans to remove the word squaw from place names in Idaho and around the country. And more recently, Idaho's Forgotten War. This is the story of the war that the Kootenai tribe in North Idaho declared on the United States in 1974. Sonia Rosario is a strong indigenous woman herself. She's Mexican-born, Mayan-identified, an international woman, as Sonia explains.
My father military was Air Force, and I got to grow up in countries as an adolescent and then a teenager. Very highly influenced by the Dutch, really highly influenced. Highly influenced by a mother who was an activist but never knew it. A feminist at heart, but an abused wife. I don't think a lot of families are, especially Latinos, don't talk about violence. It's taboo. It's like a dirty secret. You don't talk about it. And you don't talk about incest, molestation. You don't talk about those issues because it doesn't actually happen. But yeah, there was violence in my family. And I think that's probably where my mother trained me and started to really mold me in becoming a true feminista rather than a feminist. Because for me, there is a difference.
What is that difference?
The difference for me is cultural. Being a feminista, we include not just women, but we include our families. It has to be family-driven. And I'm not speaking for all Latinas because I don't know all Latinas throughout the world and in the country, but I, as a feminista, believe that as a married wife, I have to bring in my husband into the mainstream of the feminist world, the feminista world, which is cultural, tradition, language, belief structure, everything that encompasses who I am as a woman, but also as an indigenous and Latina woman. And my husband has to, he doesn't have to, I would hope that he would embrace all that I am. And, my mother told me something really interesting. She says, you teach people how to treat you. So when you get married, you actually teach your husband how to treat you. You start setting a pattern before you get married. Because if you don't, he'll set it for you. And I think that was her traditional upbringing, saying that I didn't do it, and so I accepted certain behavior that was unacceptable, not just in my culture, but throughout society, which is violence.
Well, as I mentioned to you before we started, one of my interests is in seeing us change that by using media. Do you use your media in those activist ways, whether it's violence or...
I do. I think that media plays an important role when it comes to issues that impact communities. May they be on poverty, fair trade, violence against women and children. You know, media has a powerful, it has the tool. It has the loudspeaker. And that's a very expensive. Not everybody can afford to be on TV and do commercials. Those are very expensive. So media has a responsibility and an accountability to be held accountable for putting that on TV and on radio.
Of course, who's going to hold them accountable?
It should be the people who listen to the radio stations. Those letters, editorials, yeah.
And maybe the analogy is back to the family. You teach people how to treat you. You've got to teach the media what you want.
Exactly. And I think the media sometimes is very open. Not all media is open. You know, I tend to not watch certain programs on TV or media news stations that I find very one-sided, lacks character. when it comes to women and communities of color issues. But yeah, definitely I think that, you know, we too as the public have a great responsibility, but we sidestep it. Yeah, I'll write the letter. Yeah, I'll make the phone call. And we don't do it. I too am responsible for that. You know, I get busy and I say I'm going to do it and I don't do it. I forget. And then time has passed and then I, like everybody else, I think, well, time has passed and the issue's not at hand anymore.
But now, your media work is documentaries.
Yes.
So there you have a very specific story to tell and sometimes point to make.
Yes.
Because
yes.
of the storytellers, because of the story itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How did you come into making documentaries? Is it driven from the passion to tell the story?
I think it's driven by the passion to tell the story. Truly it is. But it's also to be a vehicle that I have the ability to put individuals on film so they can tell their own story. I am the vehicle, but they are the gas. They are the gas. They steer the car in the direction that it needs to go in. And I'm highly blessed to have that opportunity and highly blessed to be in the right place at the right time with the right women. Because I make documentaries specifically on powerful women. And I think the women in Idaho are just incredible. There are so many stories tucked in Grandview and Mud Lake and Burley and Fort Hall. Like there was a story tucked in at Bonner's Ferry, Idaho. Who knew? I didn't, you know?
Idaho's Forgotten War was declared on the United States in 1974 by the 67-member Kootenai Tribe. They were a tribe without a reservation in North Idaho, near the Canadian border. They were dying of neglect and poverty. Almost 100 years prior to the war, in 1855, the Hellgate Treaty was signed over land rights of many tribes in return for reservations and the basics of health care and education. The Kootenais weren't there, though. They didn't sign the treaty, yet their land was taken. 128,000 acres. By 1974, they were down to 67 members living in shacks that had not been maintained for some 60 years. They were dying out. Until Amy Trice came along. Amy Trice was elected chairwoman of the small band in 1974, and she decided to do something about the situation. From the trailer of the documentary Idaho's Forgotten War, which features music by Peter Buffett, here's Amy.
There's a reason for it, why we're put here on earth, and whether it's to be this or to do that or whatever it's, and you'd know in your heart what you want. And I guess for me that's what always was always to help my people. Before I knew what was going on and what was going to happen, I did not know that it was prophesied that this day was going to come, that this would happen to my people, that we were going to come out of bondage. An old man by the name of Simon Francis had come and told my father, Baptist Cutsack, that we need your daughter to do something about the tribe because we are slowly deteriorating.
Margaret Freelander, Amy's cousin, recalls the situation.
The homes were falling apart. They just needed everything. And she said, do you know all we operate on is $10,000 a year to cover for health, education, and welfare? I said, well, that isn't what the promise was. The promise was that the Indians would get health, education, and welfare for the exchange of our country that they took.
Doug Wheaton was the Kootenai Tribe advisor in 1974.
They had nothing. The last money went into housing for the Kootenays was in 1934. And so in that length of time, you can just about tell how deteriorated they were. I think the degradation of the people, you know, it's hard to say a lot of things like, well, if the people, if they went to a restaurant or bar, they were expected to sit way in the back somewhere, you know, almost like the back of the bus thing in the South, that attitude. I didn't like that, you know.
James A. McClure, U.S. Senator from Idaho.
Well, I don't think it was a time when I would have wanted to be an Indian wandering around the streets of Bonner's Ferry because tension was very high.
Again, Amy's cousin, Margaret Friedlander.
One woman felt that, and it was Amy, that knew that she had to do something.
And Amy did.
I wrote a letter to the Bureau of Indian Affairs superintendent in Lafayette, said that we were go over his head. He said that there's nothing they can do. Washington, D.C., they told me I was too small, but I couldn't do anything for his members of 68 tribal members. In other words, you know, just kindly go off to the side and die. You're not worthy, you know, there's not enough of you.
When her request for a treaty received no response, she did what she said she would. She declared war on the United States of America. Margaret Friedlander.
I got up one morning, first thing I do is turn the television on, and the news that morning was a 67-member tribe, Kootenai tribe, of Idaho declares war on the United States. And oh my, it just about blew my brains out. I was so shocked. She did it. She did it.
This was all right on the heels of Wounded Knee and the activism of the American Indian Movement. There was fear on all sides. But no guns were fired. No bombs were dropped. Despite threats and fear, no Indians were killed. This time it was settled peacefully. U.S. Senator Steve Sims and Jim McClure negotiated with Amy and the tribe and reached an agreement. In just 3 days, the war was won. The tribe was given 12.5 acres of land, maintained its status as a non-treaty nation, and it was all forgotten. Senator McClure.
Rather remarkable woman, in a rather remarkable action on the part of people who felt the government had forgotten them at best. And she was going to change things, and she did.
The Kootenai tribe in Bonner's Ferry, Idaho, has grown from 67 members in 1974 to more than 165 people today. The tribe opened the Kootenai River Inn and Casino in 1986 and a fish hatchery in 1991. Income from the casino has allowed the tribe to buy back some of its original homeland. The Kootenai tribe continues to thrive. This is Yin Radio with a show on art and abuse. I've been exploring the documentary Idaho's Forgotten War with filmmaker Sonia Rosario. Sonia started making films because she had the time and the determination to tell the stories of strong indigenous women in Idaho. Her first film was The S Word, a documentary about the struggle to remove the word squaw from place names in Idaho. Like the real-life heroines in her documentary, Sonia is focused. She started making films with little more than determination and old equipment. She remembers her outdated camcorder.
It was huge. I just remember people looking and laughing because I probably looked a little ridiculous. You know, here I am with all these You know, I remember that I was at the Sacagawea opening of the center, the Sacagawea Center in Salmon, and I think Discovery was there and PBS, and they had these eloquent cameras, you know, and on these beautiful stands. I didn't even have a stand. I was I had it on my shoulder and looking through it. And, I mean, they looked, and there was this giant camcorder filming. And I remember them, you know, sort of laughing, kind of like, oh, my God, look at that desperate woman. And then when I did the interviews on the removal of the word squaw, people would have laughed if they had seen the way that some of the interviews went, because the interviews were powerful, but I was barely learning how to work a camera. And I remember this one incident, we were interviewing this powerful Native sister here in Idaho. And I can't unlock the camera. I don't know how to unlock it. I don't even know how to turn it on because it was locked. And there were some Native sisters in the room, so they came around and they're trying to turn it on, and I'm trying to turn it on. Finally, the woman we're supposed to be interviewing gets up from her chair, and she comes back, and she's trying to turn it on, and we're all like looking at each other, and finally she turns it on, and we're all just sighing. We're so happy that the camera's on, but the chair's empty because we're all standing behind the camera, and we're like, okay, we're learning. And you know, it's an experience for me. I was a babe in the woods, but thank God I was never alone. I had incredible women supporting me. Emmeline George from Fort Hall, Lenita Warjack, Valerie Fasthorse, Lita Campbell, you know, Velma Bahi and Diane Dave from the Kootenai tribe, Nancy Egan from Duck Valley Reservation, and Eleanor Little. These are incredible women that always comforted me, always gave me, always made me feel safe. Because when you're on the road, you're tired and you're lonely, and you're hearing a lot of stories that overwhelm you and also impact your thinking, impact your emotions. So when I could laugh with Valerie Fasthorse, I laughed. And when I could cry with Eleanor Little and Emmeline George, I cried. And when I could be angry and an activist and focused and determined with Lenita Warjack, I was. You know, Velma Bahi and Diane David have a very fine and soft demure about them. So I remember that when they spoke really soft, I spoke soft. So the women really taught me more than they're aware of. But it was funny, I mean, had somebody told me that I would need a mic, special lighting, a special camera, the S word would have never been made because I didn't have that skill and that talent. Nobody told me I couldn't. You know, nobody told me I couldn't make a film, so I made it. And lampshades went off the lamps and turned on all the bright lights, and I told the women to scream right into the camera. I mean, there were so many funny moments. And then there were so many moments that I would sit in my Jeep and I would cry because it was so painful. The stories were painful.
Yeah. And people open up to you in the process, too. That you have to have a way to make them comfortable. And I assume that's by being there, and not just physically, but you know, really emotionally being there and listening and caring. You give them an opportunity to tell the story, which is probably rare enough in itself, mm-hmm. but they're tough stories, so sometimes they're hard to tell. You use the word Native sisters, and I assume it's that sisterly approach that helps.
Mm-hmm. It's a bond. I have a very strong bond with certain women, and I don't take it for granted. I don't take it for granted, and you know, I don't know why it's happened. I just am comfortable. I'm just comfortable. I don't treat them any different, and they don't treat me any different. We laugh, We talk about politics. We talk about men. We joke. We just have fun and we laugh, but we know when to be serious. And they know, I think, you know, women like Valerie Fasthorst, who makes incredible strides for her community in Coeur d'Alene, for the Coeur d'Alene tribe. You know, Emmeline George, who was one of the first tribal council women in Fort Hall. Nancy Egan has made history being the first elected tribal chairwoman of her tribe in Duck Valley Reservation. These are incredible women. And these are women who work hard and should be respected. But we also laugh. We laugh. We have fun. I mean, when I go to Fort Hall, I'm with Emmeline George and some of the women elders, and we're listening to Mexican music. And we're on our way to go eat menudo, you know. But, yeah.
Do you think that being outside of the mainstream white American culture helps give you that bond and that access? At least more quickly?
Definitely. Definitely.
So being women of color, like you said, that's
well, there's
the
a there was a connection. Mm-hmm. You know,
even though the cultures are different and you're multicultural
yes. Well, and also
Many of us are. And
I look indigenous. I have an indigenous look. You know, I am an indigenous woman from Mexico. My people come from Mexico. My grandfather was Mayan. He was a Mayan Indian. And so I am Mayan identified. I'm very comfortable in my indigenous skin, in my indigenous features. My home is a dedication to my culture, to my traditions, you know. But I've also been blessed in the sense that I've been taught by some of the women elders the Indian way in North America. So I feel very connected to my Mayan roots, my indigenous roots from Mexico, and the newfound indigenous roots in Idaho, the state of Idaho.
And you also move very well and apparently feel, you appear to be quite comfortable in the more mainstream culture as well.
Yes.
You walk in both. Have you ever felt like you don't belong in either?
Yeah, I do. I do. You know, I grew up in a very white country, the Netherlands. You can't get any whiter than... Well, I thought you couldn't because Idaho is pretty white. But I think growing up as a military dependent gave me the opportunity to blend in, not melt, because I don't like that term, but blend in and grow within so many different cultures. Korean, Filipino, Puerto Rican, Cuban. Then living in growing up with the Dutch people, living on the economy and growing up with Dutch girls, Italy and Portugal, living in the economy and growing up with Portuguese girls. I think that all of that opened up a door, but I also grew up white. There was a lot of white people around me, the strategic planning of the military bases. So I grew up with some very strategic thinking as well. I think I was prepared to make some powerful films way before I started to make them. There is a very powerful story. I was living in the Netherlands when I first experienced the word squaw. I was growing up in Holland on Schusterberg Air Force Base, and this incident happened to me. I had gone with some friends to the movies, and my hair was often long and braided, or often long, and I went to the movies, and my friends and I were ready to buy our tickets, and I think my friends were ahead of me. I believe they were ahead of me. This was several years ago. I was about 12, maybe 13. And we were going to the movies on the military base, and this American GI who was selling tickets would not sell me a movie ticket. My friends had already gone in ahead of me. And I couldn't understand why. All I know is that he called me a dirty squaw and told me to get out of line. He wasn't going to sell me a ticket. Now, I don't think anybody heard it or understood what was happening because I didn't understand what he was saying. I didn't know what that word meant. And he said that my people had scalped his people. And he wouldn't sell me a movie ticket. But, you know, not understanding as a 12 or 13-year-old girl, I could read the signs of hate. You know, we all have that built in us. We can read the signs of hate and danger. And I was in danger. I remember getting out of the line, and I remember going into the bathroom and feeling lost and confused because I was supposed to be in the movie theater with my friends having fun. But I didn't understand why I couldn't go in or why I couldn't have a ticket or why I couldn't be with my white girlfriends and why I was different, what had happened. And I remembered that it was so painful that I went into the bathroom stall and I locked it and I sat on the bathroom stall and wept. I think I wept because I didn't understand what had happened to me, but I knew something incredible had changed my life. Something so painful that I would never be innocent again. And I think that's what happens when you're raped and beaten and abandoned. And it changes you. It makes you, it just makes you different. You don't see the world the same again. And I didn't. I never did. That that term itself would cause me so much grief. I remember that G.I.'s accent to this day, a thick southern accent from Alabama, Mississippi, or Missouri, from the deep south. He could have even been a Texas boy for all I know. But I never forgot his accent. And when I hear that accent, it does scare me. You know, it does. Even though I'm an adult and I know better now, or not that I know better, I'm aware. I'm not a little girl anymore. I can protect myself. But yes, that word would bring me so much pain as a child, and that I would make the film in Idaho. Is it ironic? I don't think so. Everything happens for a reason. I was prepared from the beginning.
Fighting abuse and injustice, giving women a platform and bringing them together. Sonia Rosario fights abuse with art. You can learn more about her most recent film, Idaho's Forgotten War, at idahosforgottenwar.com.
Stay.
past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive our electronic newsletter or make a contribution to support Yin Radio. Drop us a line at yinradio@vp.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. This show was produced by Andriette Piron and Sandy Billings. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Closing music is by Hungry Lucy. You can hear more from her at www.hungrylucy.com. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.